Okay, so you've had the exam. As you notice, the first part of the semester is about our current understanding of bonding, and is much more advanced than most treatments are at this level. Stuff about quantum mechanics and so on, and X-ray diffraction, and scanning probe microscopy, which all these are fairly recent things. But as we said, the most amazing thing is that organic chemists or people were able to figure out, before any of this came along, what bonds really were like, at least at a practical level. And it's amazing when you think how very small atoms are that people could figure out what the structure of a molecule was before they had any of these techniques that could reveal it or calculate it directly. So that's what we're trying to do by starting up with the chemical revolution in 1789 with Lavoisier and seeing what experiments people did and how they interpreted it and how the theory of organic chemistry developed, because this is the way of really learning how a science worked rather than just learning some facts of things. And also it's very helpful because a lot of the ideas and especially the nomenclature of organic chemistry developed during the 19th century, and it seems mysterious if you don't know where it came from. So this may help you remember names and understand how things work. So anyhow, here we go. And we started with Lavoisier last time and talked about some of his experiments and some of the things he did, the conceptual idea that he had facts and ideas and words, and these all had to come together. And we talked about he and Laplace measuring the heat content of things with a calorimeter, thinking that caloric was one of the elements, as light was for them. But one of the interesting things he did was this bookkeeping that we got to just at the end of the last lecture. He was the bookkeeper or the supervisor of bookkeeping for the firm that was contracted with the king in France to collect taxes, which was one of the reasons he met a bad end. But in this connection, he kept very careful books. So he extended the same idea to chemistry, to his analysis of compounds, as in the combustion analysis that we mentioned last time. So here, and we mentioned just toward the end that it was hard to burn things like sugar. So he had to find other ways to measure what was in sugar. So he used fermentation for that period. So here, for that purpose. So here are some of his tables from his book about his analysis of the bookkeeping for one of these fermentations. So you see in table one, he talks about the materials, what went into the fermentation. There was 400 pounds, no ounces, no grow, and no grains of water. Now, 72 grains is a grow, 8 grow is an ounce, which is 28.35. So you can figure it out. This is like pounds, shilling, and pence in English. It's tough to work with. But anyhow, that's the way they measured things. So he started this fermentation, he said, with 400 pounds of water. That's a lot of water. In fact, he didn't use that much. He used some fraction of that and then multiplied it up as to what it would be if it were 400 pounds. Okay, but he used a lot. Okay, so 400 pounds of water, 100 pounds of sugar, and then yeast. So he had 10 pounds of yeast, but he had already done some analysis of yeast and knew you could dry it. So yeast had water. So that 10 pounds of yeast, he said, contained 7 pounds, 3 ounces, 6 grow, 44 grains of water, and 2 pounds, 12 ounces, 1 grow, and 28 grains of dry yeast. Now, I didn't write this out, but I'd be interested to know what you think about that measurement. So why don't you figure out how precisely he had to do the measurement in order to get from this information about how many grains in a grow, how many grows in an ounce, how many 16 ounces in a pound, as you know, how precise his measurement had to be to have that number. I think you'll find that it's not very realistic, that this is just a manifestation of bookkeeping and arithmetic rather than actual experimental precision. Anyhow, he started out with 510 pounds of material. And then table two is the constituent elements of the materials of fermentation. So he had analyzed separately water and knew that it contained hydrogen and oxygen. So he says if he had 407 pounds, 3 ounces, 6 gro, 44 grains of water, that would be 61 pounds and etc. of hydrogen and 346 pounds of oxygen in there. That was a separate experiment where he had done the elemental analysis, the ultimate analysis all the way to the elements of water. Then if he measures water, he knows how much hydrogen and oxygen that's bringing in. That's the idea from this separate experiment he did to analyze water. And analogously with sugar, if he had 100 pounds of sugar. Now, why did he say 407 pounds, 3 ounces, 6 gro, when he used only 400 pounds of water? Why does he have 407 here if he had 400 up here? Pardon me? Because there was some of the water in the yeast. The other 7 was in the yeast, right? So he knew that the yeast and the water brought together that much hydrogen and oxygen because of the water. Okay. Then 100 pounds of sugar, he had analyzed that separately, and he knew how much hydrogen, oxygen, charcoal there was in that. Then another interesting thing for you to compare is how accurate from this is, you know, you can do currently if you have sugar, which is a carbohydrate, C plus water, right? Carbon and water, CH2O, taken several times. How accurately it comes out to be 864.28. Be interesting to know that. Okay, then he had also the yeast, which had a certain amount of hydrogen, oxygen, charcoal, and azot also, the nitrogen in there. And the total weight, therefore, is 510, as it had to be, because, you know, this is just a re-expression of that. And then he recapitulates the elements over here, where he in table 3, where he takes together the oxygen here, the hydrogen here, and so on, and finds out how much oxygen, how much hydrogen, and how much charcoal, and how much nitrogen there was at the beginning, and naturally it sums to 510 pounds exactly. Okay, so that's where he's starting from. And now you associate with Lavoisier, the idea of elements persisting by weight. Now, you could imagine there are lots of different properties that substances have, weight, volume, color, and so on. And in principle, you could imagine that any of these, or none of them, would be conserved as you went from starting material to products when you have a reaction. What he focused on here is weight, that the weight gets conserved, right? The conservation of mass. Okay, so he doesn't talk about volumes of these things or color. What he talks about is the weight. So it starts with 510 pounds, which is a certain amount of oxygen, hydrogen, charcoal, nitrogen, and then he does his reaction. And notice that this involves both proximate analysis, how much water, sugar, and dry yeast, and ultimate analysis, how much of the elements. Okay, we talked about that before, proximate and ultimate analysis. Okay, then he looks at it at the end, the products of the fermentation here. So he has CO2, we now know CO2, carbonic acid, which is oxygen and charcoal. In fact, you know what would be really fun, if you feel like doing this, is in your groups where you have 6 people, someone check this to see how close that is to current analysis for CO2 and so on, right? Each of these. You wouldn't want to do all of them yourself, but you get the idea by doing one of them. So it'd be interesting to do that, I think. Okay, then he had water. He had alcohol came out, as you know, from fermentation. Acetic acid. A dry acetic acid. That's interesting. Because I suspect what he means there is we know you can get acetic acid, but you can also get acetic anhydride. It was possible to remove water from acetic acid. We now know that the anhydride is a completely different functional group, that these two things have come together, form a bond, and lost water. Right? But for their point of view, it wasn't any different from yeast, where you heat it up and water comes out. Right? Okay, so acetic acid, residual sugar that didn't ferment, and a certain amount of yeast was left at the end. Okay? And, lo and behold, 510 pounds. Right? So indeed, the elements were conserved. This shows it. Okay, but then he could recapitulate the products the same way he did before by taking how much oxygen, how much charcoal, how much hydrogen, how much nitrogen. And so here's the proximate analysis, and over here is the ultimate analysis, just re-expressing these numbers. And again, they total So this is the elements at the start, that table three that I showed you before. This is the elements at the end, and they total, before, in all, 510 pounds, no ounces, no grow, no grains, and afterwards, 510, zero, zero, zero. Yeah?
How did you know the composition of sugar beforehand?
Yeah, it was hard for him to burn. So I'm not positive about that. We'll have to check and see where he got that. In principle, you could do it from this. If you can analyze the other things and assume that there's conservation of mass, then you could figure out from the other things it gave what it was. There would be only a certain amount of it reacted, remember, because there was residual sugar. But in principle, you could do it that way. Whether that's the way, then that's why he set out to do fermentation, was to analyze sugar. But of course, that's a circular argument if he tried to use it in this way here. So I'm not quite sure how he got that number. But I want you to look at something else here. He started with 500. So does that prove the conservation of mass? It would appear to, right? Precisely. Does it convince you? Lean, what do you think? I can't hear very well. Well, it looks really good, right? Have you done analytical experiments in lab where you measure things? Get numbers? What? Pardon me, I wasn't looking. What?
The numbers are never that perfect.
Has anybody gotten numbers that perfect? If you look out, you know, how much, 72 of these in one of these, what was the number of these in these, 16 of these in these, right? Do you think it's going to come out that way? Yeah, but he knew that when you do bookkeeping, the books have to balance, right? Now, notice here, incidentally, that the charcoal was 28-12-4-59, and here it's 28-12-5-59. Isn't that interesting? Or notice here that the oxygen was 411, but 409 afterwards. Okay. So now, how did he know some of these things? So this is the case of CO2. So let's look at this. Okay, so he has a fire burning here. So he has a red hot glass tube that goes through the coals in this oven. Okay, then he puts 28 grains of carbon in that tube before he started heating it. Of course, okay, that's 1.38 grams. And he puts water in this retort over here, right? And then builds a fire, which of course causes the water to distill through the thing. So the water moves from here through the red hot glass tube, it condenses and collects over on the left, right? But he finds that the water he gets at the end is not as much as the water he had at the beginning, right? And the carbon disappears when this happens, okay? So the water he collects here is 85.7 grains less than what he started with, right? And he lost 85.7 grains of water and 28 grains of carbon. Where did they go? Okay. Any ideas? So they must have come out the end here. Now, of course, you can really worry about this because, you know, this condenser probably has a few drops of water in it, right? It's unlikely everything collected here. But anyhow, this is what he said it was. So where did they go? Well, out here, he collected the gas the way he collects gas in these other experiments, and he got 144 cubic inches, which is 100 grains of carbonic gas, which we now know as CO2, and 308 cubic inches, 13.7 grains, of flammable gas. What's flammable gas? Pardon me? Can't hear. What's the gas that burns that came out? Any ideas? Notice what you did. You reacted carbon with water. and you get CO2. So what else do you get? You now know. H2, right? So flammable gas came out too. Okay, and incidentally, how could he separate those two gases? How could he know how much was one and how much was the other if they were both gases? This is a little review from before. How did he know how much was CO2? Or carbonic gas, as he called it. Pardon me, Carl?
Combust the
H2. Or somebody, who else? I couldn't see who was talking.
Combust the H2.
That's conceivable, but there's an easier way. He did it an easier way before, yeah.
The carbon dioxide go into water.
Say it again?
The carbon dioxide go into water.
Not into water, but into base. Remember, that's how he collected it before. He bubbled it through lime water, the base, which changes it into carbonate. Then he weighed to see how much. So he bubbled the gas that came out through that, weighed how much increase in mass there was of that, and the rest was, which he collected by volume, was the hydrogen gas. Okay, so now, but we can recalculate, if he was right that there was 28 grains of carbon, we can calculate how much CO2 and how much hydrogen should be generated. He says that there was 100 grains of carbonic gas, 13.7 grains of hydrogen, and so that totals the same as this, 113.7. So everything looks hunky-dory, the books balance, right? Okay, but if we use modern theory from 28 grains of carbon, we see he should have got 157 cubic inches that weighed 103 grains, and 313 cubic inches weighed 9.4, right? So it's unlikely that he got these numbers. I mean, I have no doubt he got the numbers somehow, but the question is how he got them. And he said, I have thought it best to correct by calculation and to present the experiment in all its simplicity. Right? Has anyone ever been heard of doing that in lab? Okay. So what were Lavoisier's contributions to chemistry? Primarily making things clear when before people just tried to obscure the truth generally. So the idea of facts, experiments, ideas, the theory he developed, and words. And summarize some of the aspects of each of these. In fact, he published all these pictures his wife had made of the apparatus. He did quantitative measurement of facts. He determined especially mass, but also volume. Remember, he could measure hydrogen by volume. Okay, the different substances he studied and analyzed, and different reactions. Although primarily it was the stuff up at the top that he contributed. I mean, for example, Scheele discovered more new substances than pure substances than Lavoisier did. And then ideas, the idea of an element, the furthest you can go in analysis, the idea of the conservation of mass, which he a little bit screwed things around in order to make sure it held from his own experiments. The idea of oxidation, that you have to start with a base, the radical of an element, then you add oxygen, and get the different levels of oxidation. The idea of this base being the radical, the root of things, and how you get an acid from it by reacting it with oxygen. And the idea of salts. Okay? So in words, he was primarily responsible for giving meaningful names not only to elements and oxidation states like us, ix, ide, ite, ate. Those are all Lavoisier's names. And a salt composition, then, where you name it by the things that go into it, right? Often have names like that in the salt. Okay, so he made the names meaningful. But, like almost all people everywhere in history, and therefore almost all people everywhere today, he didn't have the imagination that he might have had. I mean, he had a lot of imagination. But there's always a deficit of imagination. What's hard to see is where it's missing. And it's definitely missing now, but we don't know where. For example, at the close of the preface to the Traité élémentaire de chimie, he said, chemistry's present progress, however, is so rapid, and the facts under modern doctrine have assumed so happy an arrangement that we have ground to hope, even in our own times, to see it approach near to the highest state of perfection of which it is susceptible. That is, we now have all these equipment, all these different pieces of apparatus and ways of approaching things. We're almost there, right? It's going to take just a little longer, but in our own lifetimes, we'll probably see chemistry perfected, right? And even in our own times. Now, his times, unfortunately, were quite limited because he published that in 1789 and his head was cut off in 1794 because of his participation in the books of the Ferme Générale. So the judge is said, Coffinhal at his trial is said to have said the Republic has no need of geniuses. It probably, that's apocryphal. But one thing that's, but they saved all his equipment, including 80 pounds of mercury, right? And it was seized for the people, although 2 years later it was returned to Madame Lavoisier. Although no one knows, you know, he was just thrown away, his remains, no one knows where they are or where they went. And Lagrange, the guy on the stamp here, said this about that. It took them only an instant to make this head fall, but 100 years may not suffice to make another one like it. Because he really was so key in launching the chemical revolution. Okay. So we've seen Boyle, who was 100 years before Lavoisier, but you know, Lavoisier couldn't have done his stuff relating volume to weight without knowing Boyle's law about how the pressure depended on it and so on. And then we've seen Lavoisier. And now, just a little bit later, we'll talk about Dalton. Okay, now, remember I was in Manchester a little earlier and I visited this place at the Manchester Metropolitan University where there's a lab named for John Dalton and there are these pieces of marble there and it says on it, John Dalton, Cumberland man, worked in Manchester 1792 until his death. He made many advances in meteorology, right? The physics and chemistry of gases and the theory of combustion. He is remembered above all else for his concept of the atomic theory and atomic weights published in his New System of Chemical Philosophy, 1808 to 1810. So about 20 years after Lavoisier's book. And these stones form part of his memorial in a cemetery which has subsequently been destroyed. So they were moved here when the college was built in 1961. That's at the base of this statue of Dalton. And you know, whenever you see one of these things of some important figure, there's always some device that's relevant to what their contribution was. What do you see in here? Can you see what the sculptor has put in to show what kind of field Dalton worked in? There's a book. Yeah, absolutely. That's probably his New System of Chemical Philosophy. What? I can't hear very well. Yeah, something under his foot there. See what it is? It's a crucible with a retort in it that denote chemistry. But in fact, probably the main thing is his thinking about stuff. Right? So here's a picture of him where it's exactly the same, right? Holding his finger up to the side of his face while he's thinking. And in this picture, you'll notice he has this here, which is his picture of molecules, which are from that book, The New System of Chemical Philosophy. But he started in this because he was an amateur meteorologist and he was interested in the atmosphere and in particular in this question. They now knew the density of gases. So if you have gases of different density, the reasonable thing would be for the dense gases to be on the bottom and the light gases to be on top. That's what happens with solutions, right? I mean, if you mix mercury and water, the mercury's on the bottom and the water's on the top. So why don't gases of different density stratify? Why do they remain mixed? This was the question, right? Now, a number of European scientists had proposed that the different gases attract one another, so they tend to stay mixed. But Dalton says it doesn't have to be that way. So this is a picture from his paper about this. He said the atoms of one kind did not repel the atoms of another kind. Okay, so here's the idea. This is a picture of four atoms of nitrogen gas. So here's the atom itself, which is his symbol for nitrogen, as we'll see. But it's surrounded by what he called a heat envelope. And the hotter you make it, the more of these lines of the heat envelope they are. But his idea is that if you have two atoms that are of the same element, the lines of their heat envelope will match and they'll repel one another. right? But if you had nitrogen adjacent to hydrogen, this is his symbol for hydrogen, then the heat envelopes don't match, right? So they don't repel one another. So that's why they stay mixed, because they don't repel one another, whereas the same gas repels it. The same atoms repel one another. So instead of attraction between different gas atoms, there's reduced repulsion, which has the same effect in his point of view. So he substitutes homorepulsion for heteroattraction. And we now know that there's nothing to this as far as understanding why gases behave the way they do. But this is what got him from meteorology to start thinking about atoms. And in connection with this, he started doing his own analyses and in terms of atoms. Because, all Lavoisier was looking at was the weights of material. How much carbon, how much hydrogen, how much oxygen is there in a certain substance? Not how many atoms there were of it, right? But Dalton brought in the concept of atoms. So, and the law of definite proportions, of equivalent proportions, and of multiple proportions. All these are things which strongly suggested, although they in no way proved, that things were based on atoms, okay? Now, definite proportions is that pure compounds always have the same weight ratio of the elements, right? So water will always be a certain weight ratio of hydrogen to oxygen. It doesn't vary, okay? Equivalent proportions is this. Suppose a certain weight of A reacts with a certain weight of B, okay? And that same weight of A reacts with a certain weight of C. That means that with respect to A, that that weight of B is somehow equivalent to this weight of C. Okay? Now, suppose you have some other substance that a certain amount of D reacts with B parts of B. Then can you see what you might expect with respect to B, with respect to D and C reacting? Okay? Reaction with A shows that B parts of B is equivalent to C parts of C. Okay? Now you know that a certain weight of D reacts with B parts of B. So what do you infer?
A is proportional to D.
No? Oh, okay. So that's a good one. You could say that A parts of A is equivalent to D parts of D because they both react with B parts of B. Everybody got that one? And there's another one, which is the same kind of thing. If that's true, then D parts of D should react with C parts of C, because that's equivalent to that, as we already showed. Right? But that would be so if these reactions were based on mixing atoms, if they came in units, right, rather than just some sort of a fuzzy weight ratio. Okay, and then the idea of multiple proportions is if two elements form several compounds, the same two elements form several different compounds, can you think of any example they might have known of two elements coming together to give different compounds? Can you think of a case where the same two elements give two different compounds? Yes? Oh yeah, that's true, but the simple things that they're dealing with, gases, for example. Can you think of two gas? Yes.
Carbon monoxide,
carbon dioxide. One of them reacts with base; the other doesn't react with base to get absorbed in water, right? So, but the weight ratios of the elements are related by simple factors. They're multiple proportions, and we'll illustrate these things. Now, definite proportions. This was a big subject in France at this period. And Berthollet and Proust had different answers to whether the same substance always has the same ratio of elements in it. Okay, Berthollet said no. And he said that there are things like metal alloys and natural organic materials, because things like fats, we know, you know, that they're composed of different molecules, so they have slightly different ratios. But for him, a fat was a fat, but you didn't always get the same ratio, right? So things like that did not always give the same proportions of the elements. But Proust said, oui, because that is what defined chemistry. To have a if you had a pure substance, then it obeyed the law of definite proportions. So as long as you stuck to pure substances, they were always the same. But that defined what substances you wanted to study if you wanted to do a rigorous study. Right? So so chemists following this tended not to focus on things like alloys where the ratios changed, or these really complicated organic molecules. The initial progress in chemistry and understanding was enabled by focus on very, very simple molecules where you could see relationships develop, which you couldn't do if you were just dealing with really complicated things. Okay, so really that defined chemistry was Proust's idea, and that the chemists focused on things that obeyed definite proportions. And now multiple proportions. For example, as Aisha said, there were two oxides of carbon. Carbonous acid, found in 1789, was 44% carbon and 56% oxygen. Carbonic acid, analyzed 18-1, 28-72, right? Or oxides of nitrogen. There were three different oxides of nitrogen. Here is analysis from 1810 of all those, the weight ratio of nitrogen and oxygen. They're obviously different, right? So three different substances. Now, but the idea of multiple proportions is what you get by thinking about those numbers. Now, to help you think about them, let's look at the ratio of oxygen to carbon. 56 over 44 is 1.27. 72 over 28 is 2.57. Or in the case of oxygen to nitrogen ratio, it's 0.58, 1.27, 2.39. So those are the numbers these guys had to deal with. What could they figure out from that? What did they notice that was worth noting about this? Carl? Right, so this is very nearly twice that. How about in the case of the oxides of nitrogen?
It's a little more off, but
this is sort of like twice that, and this is sort of like twice that. Right? So relative, if you define this as 1 in this case, then this is 2.02, very near 2. If you define this as 1, that's 2.19, 4.12. So it's pretty much like about 2 and about 4, right? Now, of course, their numbers didn't really match this, and they didn't fiddle around with them to make them match the way Lavoisier did, right? But the art in this is that seeing that these integral values would be consistent with having simple atomic ratios, CO, CO2, N2O, yeah, N2O, NO, NO2, right? Seeing that, here's the percent error that you would get as calculated from modern numbers. Right, it should. This is off by 5%, by 4%, by 2%, and 11. Okay, so some of them were off, but great scientists have been able to focus on the key factors, despite the fact that they're hidden by these errors. Right, now that's a little bit like the chicken and the egg, right? Because the greatness of a scientist is that he identified something real, right? But what's a key factor? You know, he could have identified something else that's nonsense, like Annie Besant and the clairvoyant atoms or something like that. And ultimately, we decided that Annie Besant is not a great scientist, right? Whereas Dalton was a great scientist because he could see these things. Okay, but you don't know ahead of time who the ones that are great, only by what proves out in the long run. Okay, so we've looked at Lavoisier, and now we're getting into the next stage of elemental analysis, atoms, and the concept of dualism. And this involves the next generation of chemists, Berzelius in Sweden, whose contribution was in analysis, dualism, and isomers, as we'll see, Gay Lussac in France, and here they are on the outside. And you see, we've talked about Berzelius, we talked about Faraday, but now Berzelius, Gay Lussac, and Davy in England. And notice these guys were all born within a year, right? And in fact, beneath these things is Silliman, who was also born in the same year. Okay. Now we're going to show what they worked on. So here's Berzelius. And so the things he contributed were organic and mineral analysis. He analyzed 2,000 compounds in the course of 6 years. That's amazing when you think how much trouble it was at that time. He got good values of atomic weights for 50 elements. He was very important in studying electrolysis, in developing the theory of dualism. Notice that all these things up here are experiments, right? But this is theory, and the idea of reaction by double decomposition, we'll talk about that. And then in words, in teaching, writing, and editing. And see, what he chose to have in his portrait was not only the medal the king gave him, but his textbook that he wrote in 1808. And in developing notation for the composition of substances. So notation for composition. So we had the symbols of alchemy became the symbols of Dalton, became the symbols of Berzelius. So let's look at what those are. So here are chemical symbols from a publication in 1774, just before Berzelius was born, from Sweden. And you see the symbols for all these things. First, they give the Latin alchemical style names and the alchemical symbols for all these substances. For example, this one, vitriolum cupri, cerulium. Right? Okay, now, and on the outside of the building, you see this. Copper had this alchemical symbol, and that's the symbol that's given for copper here. Right? And this meant it was what we now call the sulfate salt. Okay, or here's iron sulfate, right? Or here's mercury salt, lead acetate there, for example. Okay, so those, and notice in particular up here, nitrum, which is the element for involved in nitre, right? And that is the one that became Dalton's symbol for nitrogen, right? But for Dalton, these are very different. These are the symbols of individual atoms, not of substances, but of elemental atoms, right? So then he had all these elements, all these elemental symbols, and notice he had things like here. Here's one with I. I can't read that. Let's see, this is iron. This one's Z, that's a Z, zinc, C for copper, L for lead. He's English, S for silver, P for platinum, G for gold, and so on. But when Berzelius came to make the symbols, he gave them, he based them on Latin names instead of English names, not too surprisingly. Okay, but then Dalton, in this 1808 publication, showed binary combinations, so molecules based on the elements, right, the definite proportions. So he had one-to-one mixtures of H with N, N with O, H with C, O with C. Okay? Now, Dalton's logic in doing this, he says, is when only one combination of two bodies could be obtained, that is, two elements, it must be presumed to be a binary one, that is, one-to-one. The things will be one-to-one. That's how you can know how big the atoms are, right, relative to one another. Unless some other cause appear to the contrary, there's the weasel words in his definition, right? So then he says, so then here are ternary compounds, N2O, O2N, right? H2O. Or no, what is this one? CO2. CO2. CH2. Right? So he says when two combinations are observed, they must be presumed to be a binary and a ternary. So you can have a binary compound NO and a ternary compound NO2. And when there are three, then you have a binary and two ternary. So you can have NO, NO2, and N2O. But this is just parsimonious, right? And we know now that that in general it's not true, this idea, right? When four, one binary, two ternary, one quaternary, etc. Okay, but this is then Berzelius' notation for the same thing, and all he did was Berzelius used superscripts, we use subscripts. Otherwise, Berzelius' notation is exactly what we use today. Now, what does it show about the substance, Berzelius' notation? It shows the atom ratio of the compounds by weight, right? It doesn't show any. These things show structure, although Dalton had no idea what, no means of proving how the atoms were arranged. They seem to show structure here, especially the ones like this, right? But Berzelius' notation has nothing about structure in it, only the elemental analysis expressed in atoms. So he chose to base it on Latin rather than English, so it would be international, and analytical, not structural, the Berzelius notation. So this is a page from a Berzelius publication book, and you see that he has symbols here like these little dots over chromium, which is to, a dot denotes an oxygen atom. So this is KO with CrO3. We now know that we would write it as KCrO4, right? But he wrote it as KOCrO3. Okay, or down here, this is various acids, acetic, tartaric, citric, benzoic, gallic acid. So benzoic acid, he has H12C15O3, right? We now know that it should be H10C14O3. It's not benzoic acid. It's benzoic acid that has been purified by removing the water, which of course made it into the anhydride group, not the original acid. But again, they had no way of knowing that the water was an intrinsic part of the molecule, not some hydrate that could just be removed. But he suggested symbols for these things here, but they didn't catch on, so we don't use those nowadays. But a lot of the stuff we do keep, as you see. Okay, now, atomic weights and equivalents. So here are Dalton's atomic weights. Hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. I forget, phosphorus is one of these. Here's what they are. We have them. So these are the Berzelius symbols for the same elements. And here's what we take their atomic weights to be rounded off in 2009. So, how good was Dalton? Awful?
He was good at hydrogen.
Pardon me, Arvin?
He was good at hydrogen.
He was good at hydrogen. Is he bad at the others? Yeah, they're in increasing order. That's true. But was he off by a zillion fold, or by? How much was he off by? What's the problem? Can you see with Dalton's atomic weights? Where did he get into trouble? If he assumes that H is one, because he could assume one of these, they're relative to one another, so getting H right is not a big deal. Okay, so if he assumes H is one, then how does he know how much oxygen is if you assume H is 1? You take water and see what fraction is hydrogen, what fraction is oxygen, right? And you find out that there's he got 7 for that. Is that about the right number? Why do we get 16 when he got 7? I mean, obviously his experiments weren't so great, yeah. He used what? No, it's a little more complicated than that. Yeah. Ah, remember what he said? If you have a binary compound, If you have a single compound, it's binary, HO. Right? We now know it's H2O. Right? So in fact, it should be, instead of 1 to 7, it should be 1 to 14. Right? Oxygen is twice as heavy compared to a single hydrogen as it is compared to two hydrogens, right? So he should have gotten 14. He should have gotten 16. He got 14. So it's not great, but it's not as bad as you might have thought at the beginning. In fact, we can look at it. This is 1 to 1 to 2 to 3 divided by 2 roughly, divided by 3 roughly, divided by 2 roughly, right? So they aren't great. This is the percent error in all these. Okay, actually, is that right? Yeah. Okay, good. So he's within about 10% for most things, or a little bit worse. Okay. But then there was the case of silicon chloride, which Thomas Thomson in Scotland said was SiCl. Gmelin said it was SiCl2 in Germany. Berzelius in Sweden said it was SiCl3. And Odling in England said it was SiCl4. How can you possibly know which one it is? Right, because these are all going to give different atomic weights. Well, Joseph-Louis Gay-Lussac in France, who was noted, probably more people know him from the fact that he held the human altitude record at 7,016 meters for a long time for ascent in a balloon. Notice he's carrying a big flask. Why do you think? What? To measure how high he was? No, he could have done that, but there were better ways probably measuring how high. What would Dalton have been interested in if you could get up so high? Yeah. Pardon? The pressure, yeah, that's what Sebastian said down here. You could use the pressure to judge the altitude. You could check the variation of pressure with altitude, yeah. Right, to see whether the composition of the gases was the same at 7,000 meters as it was at ground level. Right, and he showed that they were established, the atmospheric composition was invariant with altitude. Okay, he also found a way to oxidize sugar by using a very potent oxidizing agent, sodium chlorate. So he was able to clean up a lot of Lavoisier's stuff where he hadn't been able to do combustion well. But he also found that water if he gives one volume of oxygen, it gives 1.9989 volumes of hydrogen. Right? So even though the weights could have been anything, the volumes of the gases were very close to an integral ratio, too. Right? So it suggests that it was H2O, right? Or ammonia would give one volume of nitrogen 3.08163 volumes of hydrogen. So again, very close. Remember, Lavoisier focused just on mass, but Gay-Lussac points out if you focus on the volume of the gases, then you get something that could be related to the atomic theory, right? So this was an alternative to Dalton's law of greatest simplicity, that a binary compound must be HO, right? This says it should be H2O. Okay, whose name do you associate with that concept we just talked about the volumes of gases being related? You know, that's Avogadro, right? That the same number of moles gives the same volume of a gas. Okay, and then Eilhard Mitscherlich looked at crystals very carefully. So he had this a crystal goniometer, where you'd mount a crystal there, send light in and bounce off the surface of the crystal up this telescope, and this could be very, very precise in how a crystal surface is oriented by the angle it reflects. When big snowflakes fall, look at this and close one eye and then the other, right? And what you'll see is some snowflakes and then other snowflakes, because the ones that are reflecting the sun will hit one eye and not hit the other. So you could be within hundredths of a degree, really, measure things this way. So he could, so he mounted the crystal there, and then he'd rotate it by a certain number of degrees, which you could measure accurately with this magnifying glass here, till you get another crystal face that has exactly that, and then you could measure the angle between those two. So it measures the angle between crystal faces. So here's a publication from 1821 on the relation that exists between crystalline form and chemical proportion. So it was arsenates and phosphates, right? Arsenates and phosphates. Okay, so these are crystals of arsenates or phosphates, ammonium crystal. So ammonium biarsenate and biphosphate. But they have the same shape. Okay? So here are the angles he measured on crystals of the arsenate. Here are the angles on the corresponding phosphate. And if you compare these, you see they differ by always less than a degree, usually just a few tenths of a degree. Right? So these crystals have the same shape even though they have different elements. So he inferred from that. There was this need for relative atomic weights. Is water HO or H2O? At least in the case of arsenic and phosphorus, this isomorphism, the same shape, provided definitive atomic weight ratios for some pairs, because arsenic atoms must play exactly the same role in arsenates that phosphorus atoms play in phosphates. If they didn't play the same role, they wouldn't have the same shape for these things. So that means that however much arsenic, if you take 100 grams of nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen in these ammonium things, and that combines with this amount of phosphorus or this amount of arsenic, so that amount of phosphorus must be the same number of atoms as that amount of arsenic. So an arsenic atom must be 2.5 times as heavy as a phosphorus atom. It can't be half that or twice that, right? Because then they wouldn't fit into the same place. So this idea of isomorphism allowed in certain cases to tell what the atomic ratio was, whereas in other cases it was just, and also you had Gay-Lussac's idea of things that could be in gases, that the volume would relate to that. Okay, we'll continue with this next time. Incidentally, the answer key is on the web for the exam. I'll give the exams back on Friday. Were there some problems for Friday? I think there were, weren't there? Just some of these analytical things. And then the things I talked about today would be fun to do too.